Hi everyone, welcome to the Pathfinder 101 podcast. Today's guest is Reverend Stephen Arbogast, chaplain at St. Mark's School of Texas. This first question is, could you talk a little bit about your journey from maybe the end of high school to where you are today?
When I finished college, during college, I became Roman Catholic. My family is Protestant. As a result of that, I then entered a religious community called the Society of Jesus, commonly known as Jesuits. I was a Jesuit for a number of years until I found that I could not remain in the Catholic Church. It's another long story. And unfortunately, you cannot remain a Jesuit if you're not Roman Catholic. So I had to leave the society. If I had not needed to leave, I would have happily stayed for the rest of my life. Was not sure what I was going to do and ended up with Goldman Sachs in finance in New York, where I stayed for over a dozen years, but knew forever that that was not where I wanted to stay forever. And so at the end of 12 years, I entered the Peace Corps for 4 years, was in Benin, West Africa, and then was in graduate school at Yale and Harvard for 4 years. And then since then, I've been working in independent schools in New York and Washington here in Texas. Also, as part of that process, I had become an Episcopal, I was ordained an Episcopal priest as well. So that gives you a little bit of the narrative arc.
Could you talk more in depth about like what the graduate programs that you pursued entail?
Sure. So one is an academic degree and one is a professional degree. I forgot to mention that since I've been here in Texas, I've also done a doctoral degree at Perkins School of Theology, which is an academic degree as well. So the MDiv is a professional degree. I did that at Yale, and that allows you to be professionally accredited to be ordained in some religious community. And for me, that means the Episcopal Church. That was 3 years, and my focus was on applied ethics in a general sort of a way. Then the degree I did at Harvard was an academic degree, which is preparatory for doing a doctoral degree. And that degree was also in applied ethics, but more specifically in African business and professional ethics. And then the last degree that I've just recently completed was a doctoral degree at Perkins School of Theology attached to SMU. And that was in the study of spiritual and ethical formation for people age 6 to 26. And that is a professional doctorate degree rather than an academic doctoral degree, although it is a terminal degree. So each of those straddled the difference between an academic program and a professional degree. So the degree at Yale and the degree at Perkins is like getting a law degree or a medical degree. They are professional degrees rather than academic. And the one at Harvard was an academic degree.
So it seems like you spent a lot of time in various universities. Could you talk about the motivations behind that? Like what each degree plays, like the role that it plays like in your day-to-day?
Sure. It partly goes back to when I was a Jesuit, where the purpose of education was to be as widely educated as possible so that you could do whatever the task is that's set before you, not knowing whether that task was going to be in Korea or Peru, not knowing whether that task would be in a high school or parish or university. And so the purpose was to be as fully educated as possible in order to be able to best take on the task that you probably didn't even know was going to happen until it happened. So some of those degrees were to be ordained as an Episcopal priest. Some of them were for academic purposes so that eventually I'd be able to publish. So each one of them had slightly different purposes.
Could you also briefly explain your role as a school chaplain, the different responsibilities that fall under that?
Sure. So one of the reasons I wanted to be ordained was to do ministry, and I could have done in a parish, I could have done in a school. So the first thing to know about school chaplaincy is it doesn't require someone to be an ordained person. There are lay chaplains in schools all over the country, all over the world. And there are also chaplains beyond schools in military services around the world, in hospitals and in corporations and in prisons. So there are lots of different kinds of chaplains, and some are ordained members of communities and some are lay people. And I happened to be ordained and was interested in being ordained and felt I should be ordained, but that's not a requirement. So what do chaplains do? There are a couple of different things. Two big categories pretty much all chaplains do, And then one thing I do here at St. Mark's that's not necessarily distinctive of other experiences of chaplaincy. The one is to be the primary officiant at liturgical services, religious services for whatever the institution is. So at hospitals and in the army and at schools, that means conducting both regular chapel services on a weekly or even more frequent basis, as well as being available to help people who have funerals and weddings, for example. Then in addition, there's what I'll call chaplaincy, which is to provide pastoral care for people. And that would be to be with people and provide counseling and support, both when there is a problem, a death in the family, for example, or a significant illness or a hospitalization. But also if a family, if a couple is getting married or they're having a child, something happy and celebratory, it's also the person who helps them prepare to enjoy those experiences to a richer level than they would otherwise. So those are the two things that pretty much everyone does as a chaplain, whether it's in a school or a hospital, wherever you are. The third thing that I do here at St. Mark's that's distinctive to what I do here that is not in other places is working with chapel council. And chapel council here are organizations on each of the divisional levels that help students study and embrace and learn more about religious diversity in their own lives and within their community. And they also help out with the chapel services, and they also help out with chaplaincy. But that's a unique thing that I do here at St. Mark's, that if you were speaking to a chaplain from a hospital or the military, they would not have something equivalent to that. So I do pastoral care as chaplaincy. I lead liturgical services and as chaplain, and also I develop and support chapel council programs.
Can you talk a little bit about what made you consider a career in or being a chaplain or in religion over the other different options available?
Yes. So when I was a kid, going through all the stuff that any kid goes through, two sources of support for me, places where I felt safe and felt supported, were the school and the church. And so because I felt blessed by God, I wanted to give back, and I felt I should give back in the arenas in which I'd received the support and care in the first place. I suppose that if I had admired or been supported or encouraged by a coach or an art teacher, a politician, I might have felt that I'd want to respond by following in their footsteps. But it just turned out to me that it was the church and the school, the way I felt the most support and love and encouragement. So that's what I thought. In addition, there were two people that as a kid I greatly admired. One was a guy named William Sloan Coffin, who was the chaplain at Yale University. And he was very famous and very significant, a national figure, a prophet at his time. And I was very envious and so impressed by the work that he did, I wanted to be like him. And the other was a guy named Frederick Buechner, who actually just died a couple of weeks ago or so in his 90s. He was a chaplain at Exeter, which is a boarding school in New England. He had gone to Lawrenceville, I think, earlier. And so because he was a role model for me as both a writer and also as a chaplain at those boarding schools in New England, I wanted to model my life after his in some respect and be like someone like Frederick Buechner. So Frederick Buechner and William Sloan Coffin were role models for me as a kid in trying to figure out how to serve both the schools and the church with my life.
Could you talk a little bit about some of your daily responsibilities?
Yes. So there's no typical day in terms of the routine of any particular day, but there are categories of things that are the same all the time. So one category of things would be chapel-related activities, and those would be the writing of chapel talks, the planning of chapel services, including what prayers should we do, what music should we sing, what the theme of the chapel should be. So some chapels' services have a theme, like Rosh Hashanah or Diwali or Lunar New Year, and then some chapels are regular ordinary chapels, and they don't have any particular theme except the theme that I give it. So part of what I do each day is organizing the chapel services, which includes making sure that there are readers, making sure that there's music, thanking the people who've spoken in chapel, all the stuff connected to the chapels. Then there were things connected to chaplaincy that I don't really know from day to day how much there's going to be. I might get an email and there might be three students whose grandparents have died in the last day, or there might be a whole week where no one has died. I might get a call from someone who wants to get married and they are interested in knowing how to plan a service or what they need to do to have the marriage to be a successful one. Or I might not hear from someone who wants to get married for months at a time. There might be someone who was an alum whose family would like him to be buried out of St. Mark's. And that would be a very intensive thing that would be on the spur of the moment. Obviously, you can't plan for most funerals. So the chaplaincy would be another whole category of events. In addition to that, it would be a matter of speaking with the head of the school and the senior administrative team, of which I'm a member, the senior administrative staff, what the policies should be for the school regarding memorials and weddings. Whose weddings will we do and which ones won't we do? Which memorials will we do, which we won't? So, you know, it's not just that anybody off the street would say, I'd like to have a memorial service at St. Mark's. And we'd say, sure, that's fine. It's not like a hotel. So it would be both managing those events, dealing with the families that are impacted by it, as well as helping the school figure out the policies related to it. And then there are the things regarding chapel council. We have a very, very robust lower school chaplaincy program and a very robust upper school chapel program. And on any given day, we are either planning something, reflecting on something we've already done, or in the midst of actually doing something itself. And that could be sometimes very intensive all day long, or it could be something which is just a matter of a couple of phone calls or some emails or a lunch with somebody. So it varies. So it's not so much that my days are the same every day as much as they are dealing with these three chunks of thing. I also, because I'm a member of the faculty, teach a class, and I also have other responsibilities just as a regular ordinary faculty member and member of the community and member of the senior administrative staff that anybody on the A-team would have. So in addition to the kinds of things that I do in terms of chaplaincy stuff.
It seems like you have many responsibilities on your plate. Could you talk about which one is your favorite and which one you like the least?
Oh, well, you know, this is one of the advantages of school ministry and about ordained ministry in general, because more and more increasingly, both in the 20th century and now at the 21st century, even more so, most professionals are increasingly specialized. And so the more you know about what you do, the more specific your work becomes. So in most jobs, let's say you're a city planner, you start off thinking about plans for all cities, and then you start learning only about educational parts of a school, of a city's plan. Then you start focusing on lower school education. Then you start focusing on first grade education. You know, it gets increasingly narrow. So one of the cool things about what I do is it's one of the very, very few jobs left in America which are generalist. On any one day, I can be thinking great abstract philosophical thoughts, or I am refilling the candles in the chapel because they need to be refilled. So in terms of the kinds of things I do, it is very much a wider range than most professional people have in the world. In terms of what I like or don't like, you know, because it's so varied, there's a huge advantage in that you can spend an hour thinking about what you want to talk about in a chapel program, like a chapel talk, and it can be very abstract and very theoretical and very sort of thinking, what do I want to say? And then you get exhausted from that. That's when you go and you fill the candles with the oil that they need. You can try to plan out, because I teach a history class, what do I want to teach for the year? And when you're tired of that very generalized abstract idea, you can grade yesterday's quiz. So it's not as if I love some things more than others. It's that each one offers recreation from the other kind of activity. So I love talking with people and listening to people. I just had a conversation for about an hour this afternoon with a member of the community about the Hindu tradition in the greater Dallas area. And we talked and talked and talked and talked. It was wonderful. And that was a fabulous hour. When it was over, I had three student meetings in which I went over things like footnoting and bibliographies, very concrete, very specific, not at all abstract and not at all grand. So each was wonderful for itself. I would not want to do either one of them 24/7. The cool thing about what I get to do is I get to do these wide range of different kind of activities. And when I'm tired of one thing, I can do the other. So it really isn't anything that I don't love doing. It's that I love to do them at different times and in moderation. You know, there's really nothing that I'd want to do exclusively. Planning for the year is fabulous, but if I never got to actually do the events, well, that would not be great.
I believe earlier you mentioned that you spent some time in South Africa and in Benin. So could you mention maybe some highlights of those experiences or some lessons you learned from those and how they impact you today?
Sure. So I was in West Africa and Benin for 4 years, full time, the whole time, Francophone country. I hardly had any chance to speak with English and with anybody at all. And then I was down in South Africa 4, 5, or 6 summers for about 10 weeks each time. And I had also been in Nigeria for summer as well. So I was back and forth to Africa a number of times. When I was in Benin, I was with the Peace Corps. And so for the first 2 years, I was with a farming export organization, and I was there to help farmers become better organized. I was living upcountry in a small provincial county seat, equivalently, and I tried to help them learn management organization techniques. The last 2 years, I was teaching at their equivalent of Grand École, which is the National Economics Institute. It's all French-speaking, it was all Francophone. And there, the students, I was teaching management and organization. So for the students in Benin who had aspirations to work in a large multinational corporation, they needed to learn the kinds of skills and values that were necessary. And I taught them that for the 2 years that I was there. When I was in South Africa, I was teaching at the first English language, and it may have been any boarding school in the entire continent, in a town called Grahamstown. It's where Rhodes University is. And there was actually 6 boarding schools there. And I was there teaching the seminarians qualitative research based upon work I'd done at Harvard Business School, and was, primarily I was teaching them qualitative research skills, interviewing skills and surveying and all those kinds of things, because they were not interested in doing academic work, but they wanted to learn how to better interview people and how to better do surveys and help people learn more about their communities. And those qualitative research skills were useful to them. So I did that and I was also doing my own personal research on African business and professional ethics, which was connected to the work I did at Harvard, which was on, as I mentioned to you, business and professional ethics from an African standpoint.
Aside from pursuing academics in various universities, you've also achieved some different certifications. I believe one of them was suicide prevention. So could you talk about what made you to pursue these certifications and what role those play in your day-to-day job?
Sure. And what was the one you mentioned?
I think suicide prevention was one.
Oh, right. So for a long, long time, I worked with 2 areas of interest, which meant quite a lot to me. So first of all, when I was 17 years old, I ran the political campaign for a presidential candidate when I was a boy and won the election over 4 counties as the youngest elected delegate to a national political campaign. And I loved it. One of the things I learned from that experience was I was not interested in partisan politics, working for a particular party. I was more interested in issue politics, working for advocating a particular stance on an issue, regardless of what the political party was. And the 2 issues that meant the most to me were international human rights, which I did at a very, very senior level with Amnesty International, which I was at one point one of the senior people responsible for research on the former Soviet Union. And the other was on suicide prevention work. And this was at a time when, unlike today, when people called who are feeling suicidal, you could only call your local community. So there were local communities all over the United States, all over the world. There were several organizations that did this kind of work. You couldn't do as you can do now. You could call a number now and talk to someone in London or Atlanta or Toronto or Sydney or Seoul, anywhere, and they would be able to help you when you were feeling suicidal. So in those days, it was more locally based. So in Boston, New York, and Washington, each of those cities, I did suicide prevention work. helping people who were feeling suicidal right at that moment. And then the goal was to help them get to a point where they could get some professional help. And then obviously it was beyond what I could do in the telephone. So I specialized on weekend work. I always ever worked on either a Friday night or Saturday night, usually for a 12-hour shift, and usually did it every other week. And it was helping people who were feeling suicidal on a weekend in the middle of the night. And my goal was to help them get to the morning. And then when they got to the morning, then they really need to get professional help at a hospital with a counselor or a therapist or something. But my goal was to get them through the night. And I did that for a long time in a number of different cities and a couple of different organizations. So when I did that, the human rights work and the suicide prevention work, I don't know why did I get involved in them in those. I guess it must have been just, I don't actually know. It must have been just that I had met people along the way and I admired and respected their work. I had worked in soup kitchens and I'd worked with the homeless and I've done a lot of different kinds of things. But, and there were lots of different things I could have done. But those were the two areas that were the ones that touched my heart the most.
I think earlier we were talking about how you chose to delve into school chaplaincy and you talked about school and the church were some of the places that you spent your most time at. Could you also talk about some of the other options or roles that you considered and why you ultimately did choose to continue with school chaplaincy or go into school chaplaincy?
Well, I'm young enough to think that I hope this is not it. This may not be the last thing I do until I'm 110. Who knows what's going to come across the door. So, you know, there are lots of things people can do. And I love what I'm doing and I love where I am. But I don't know that this is the only thing I'll ever do until forever. There are other things that I love doing. First of all, outside of the church or outside of education, my heavens, I had considered urban planning. I considered law. I considered a career in historical work and history. There are lots and lots and lots of really wonderful, cool, fabulous jobs I could have done. The closest of the non-church school jobs that I did not ultimately choose would probably be management consulting. I love consulting. The whole world of management consulting is just so interesting to me. And if I wanted to work 90 hours a week, I mean, that's a place I could go and spend happily many, many, many years. But within the world that I have chosen, you know, I could be working in a parish. I don't particularly have any strong desire to do that, but I could be doing in a parish and I could be working in a parish at some time in the future. And I love schools. I think pre-K through 8 schools in the Episcopal Church, of which there are about 1,200 in the country, are just about the best thing the Episcopal Church has ever done. And pre-K through 8 schools are fabulous. So I could easily, in my sleep, would love being ahead of one of those schools. The other thing I love doing is being the second in command of a large school. So a pre-K through 12 school as an associate head, I would love to do that. I'm very, very good at that kind of work. So there are lots of things that I could do. But I think one of the advantages of doing something that you love is that you can do it until something comes across the door that says, are you interested in this? Could you do that? And sometimes you say yes, and sometimes you say no. So there's a lot of things I could do. There's a big world out there. It is so interesting. If I lived to be 1,000 years old, I could do 50 different things and love each one of them with a great deal of passion.
We're reaching the last couple of questions. So this next one is, what are some non-technical skills that are really useful in being a chaplain? And how did you develop those skills?
So I think there are two that are fundamental. I think one has to do with, I guess, no, there were three. So there are three. One is a larger category of things called cultural intelligence. And it was very important in business. And I think it's very important in life in general. It's being able to study and understand, and more than just understand, but to empathize with, and more than just empathizing and understanding with, being able to act in a way that helps people from different cultural backgrounds feel connected. So that means that if I'm in South Africa or if when I was living in France or when I was living in Germany or when I was living in Benin, being able to deal with people in a way that they felt that they were being listened to and heard is a very valuable skill. And so it's not unique to what I do, but it's, I think, important for all professionals around the world. So just for example, you walk into a Parisian shop and there are certain customs and traditions that are quite different than in the United States or in Japan. And if you follow the rules, the cultural rules People will love you. They will help you. It will be very, very comfortable. If you don't follow the rules, they will be annoyed with you. You may get what you want, but you may not get exactly what you want. It will be an unpleasant experience. So I think the whole world of what's called cultural intelligence is one of those skills. The other two things I think is being able to be proactive in what we call active listening, which is not just listening to people in a conversation or listening to what people say, but trying to help them articulate things that they themselves don't even know yet because they are telling a familiar story and they don't realize what they've left out, or they are telling a familiar story and don't realize the analogs or the metaphors may or may not work well for their audience. And so I think the other skill is what we call active listening. So being a full member of a conversation to get the best out of someone, not to debate with them, not try to convince them of what I think about something, but to really fully understand why they think what they think and then help them to articulate that. And I think then the third thing would be from the spiritual tradition of mindfulness, active mindfulness, being fully attentive to the present moment so that when we're in a crisis, you can be that grounded presence. I used to be a chaplain at Yale New Haven Hospital. I did the weekends every other weekend I was there. And I was there from 7 o'clock in the evening till 7 o'clock in the morning. And it was a trauma one unit for all the major accidents along 95 in New Haven. And if you are able to practice mindfulness, I remember the one night we had, oh my gosh, there was an accident. Two young people were killed. The driver survived and his buddy did not. And they ended up killing a cop or a police officer or a fireman or something. Anyway, every cop and every fireman was there and there was some crime involved. They were not happy with the guys who were now critically wounded. The family of the kid that died was not happy that the driver was surviving. So they were not very sympathetic. There was chaos. It was a very, very, very difficult situation. The doctors, the nurses, the paramedics, the police, the fire, everyone was there, and they're all super, super, super tense. To be able to be present to them fully and to listen carefully to what they're saying and to be able to use cultural intelligence to realize that the one cop or the one fire guy and that to kind of connect with them with each of the different cultural backgrounds required that I be as fully grounded as I could be and not add to the chaos by getting freaked out by everything around you. So when the cops or the surgeons start screaming, yelling because there's something happening, not to take it personally, to try to keep it calm and to try to be a conduit for as much peace as you can in the middle of a chaotic situation. So so that's sort of what I was thinking at the time. So
those are some great points, and all of those skills are useful in all walks of life, anywhere, in all aspects. So thank you for that. Last question I have is, do you have any final thoughts or comments to share before we end this podcast? Any suggestions or advice that you would give to people in high school considering what career they want to pursue in their lives, or maybe they're even leaning towards something religion?
I think there are two things. One is, I remember at Princeton, they used to tell people that when you come in as a freshman, you should plan to have 7 careers in your life. People live a long time. And so very different than the old days where you would graduate college, you get a job with some corporation and you'd stay there from age 21 to 65, and then you'd retire. And then you know, that was your life. That's not the world anymore. So there are jobs that young people today will be taking when they're 40 or 60 or 80 that don't even exist now. So that means that when you're a young person looking at the world, you want to think about not becoming so fixed on any one path that you close yourself off to the opportunities that come along that are a complete surprise to you until the day that they arrive. So I think the first thing is to be open to the possibilities that don't even exist yet. And so how do you do that? This is where you have to be a little countercultural, because the culture rewards a specialization. As I mentioned to you earlier, you gain social status in your field, you gain money. and power and status by becoming more and more and more specialized in some one tiny thing. So I think the other thing I would say to you is it's a balance, but to try not to be too specialized too soon and try to both revel in the glory of becoming an expert in some really tiny specific field, but also try to enjoy and appreciate the wider context in which each of these specializations takes place, so that you won't end up as a 40 or 60 or 80 year old and not be able to meet the transitions in society and the real cool and interesting things that are going to happen that we don't even know about yet. So I think those are the two things. Both is try not to be too focused on one thing and not open yourself to possibilities. And the other is to be, I guess, sort of appreciative of the variety that's going to come along and not feel like you've got to fight it, but to enjoy it and revel in it as it comes along.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your day for this interview. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all the advice you gave. I definitely learned a lot about being a school chaplain and the other various roles you've pursued. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks to everyone who's listening for choosing to spend your time with this podcast. I really appreciate it. Please be sure to check out pathfinder101.com for more content like this. Thank you, and have a great rest of your day.